This is Carl Bott and Ted Leidy.
We want to invite you to our new show, Man Up, the fourth Thursday of each month, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM.
Man Up, 6 to 7 p.m., where we explore the lost art of being a man.
Spirits, cigars, and hit the ground running when you get up in the morning. That's what Man Up's going to be about.
Oh, don't forget motorcycles, guns, and hard work every day.
And those things that men talk about when women aren't around.
That's right. Even cooking sometimes.
Even cooking sometimes. People, places, and things.
Serving your family, your community, and your country.
Man Up. Fourth Thursday of each month from 6 to 7 p.m. right here on Free Fire Radio.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
The danger of this kleptocracy, right, this union, this great awakening that occurs around 2015, the great danger is that it destroys our concept of citizenship.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Dr. Kevin Slack, Associate Professor of Politics at Hillsdale College and your teacher for Hillsdale's new online course, The American Left, From Liberalism to Despotism. We'll preview that course today with Dr. Slack. It's available now at online.hillsdale.edu. Dr. Slack, thanks so much for joining us.
It's good to be here.
This course is based at least somewhat, if not largely, on an upcoming book of yours, which is called War on the American Republic, How Liberalism Became Despotism. We're going to have you back in a couple of weeks to have an in-depth conversation on the book. Today we talk more about the online course. And I've heard you say that people ask you often, what happened to my country? When people ask you that, how do you interpret that question? What do you think that they mean?
I think it's basic things like how is it that what we call health today is the very opposite of health? I mean, it's literally sickness. You know, for example, our assistant secretary of health and the nation's first so-called female admiral is a biological male who had his own penis removed. And what world is that healthy? or they see the federal government endorse the most divisive racial tribalism, blaming all the country's problems on white supremacy, and that includes the recent murder of a black man by five black cops.
Mm-hmm.
So despite the decades-old teaching of equality under the law, we now tell whites to apologize for their skin color, even to the point of being told not to apply for jobs. That, you know, and most importantly, I think, and this goes back to 2020-21, that the COVID lockdowns, during those lockdowns, citizens saw that they really had no natural rights that were respected by the government, including speech, religion, association, assembly, rights that could not be taken away, and yet that only applied to those who were not connected to political power. So, you know, for example, Home Depot was deemed essential,
mm-hmm.
While churches were not and had to be shuttered.
So who are some of these people, these thinkers, these sort of mid-20th century liberals that you examine? What are the changes that they helped to implement in that time?
Well, arguably the father of liberalism, the one recognized as the most important and American political philosopher in the first half of the 20th century is John Dewey. And Dewey helped introduce the new experimentalist philosophy, which in some was an outlook, a view that rejected all absolutes, and it recast science instead of looking to immutable truth as a method. And so rejecting this possibility of immutable truth, it became the application of falsifiable hypotheses. And this method would be applied in every area of human inquiry, right, such as the older liberal arts, which would now be social sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And so while Dewey himself didn't want to separate facts and values, that was precisely the teaching that it introduced in education. And this was to the abandonment of the older idea of the liberal arts. And so Dewey's ideas of scientific expertise were applied to politics. There would be new relationship, for example, between government and business, government and the family, and so on. So in the realm of government and business, they would be partners, with government as the senior partner in planning the economy. So the liberals overturned the older constitutional order And they did this by creating a regime where Congress would delegate lawmaking authority to unelected bureaucrats in what were called the Big Six regulatory boards and commissions.
You, earlier in our conversation, used the phrase neoconservative. That's one that people are familiar with. But you also use the phrase in this online course, neoliberal, and people might not be as familiar with that term. What is the neoliberal consensus that you discuss?
Well, neoliberalism refers to a consensus among political elites from the late 1970s to, it seems to me, about 2008. For example, Milton Friedman and John Rawls, and I discuss both of these in the lectures, they seem like polar opposites. Milton Friedman arguing for free markets, limited government, while John Rawls was arguing for a new kind of political order, justice is fairness, in which you could treat groups differently under the law, and what he called his difference principle. And at the same time, we look at Republicans and Democrats in the 80s and the 90s, and we seem to see only partisan rancor. But, you know, both parties agreed on some basic ideas. So the so-called New Democrats of the 1980s and the Republicans were libertarian on personal moral issues while being what, you know, we'd call conservative on economic issues.
Mm-hmm.
For the Democrats, there was a general recognition that the mid-century liberals' economic planning, their big fiscal policies of the 1960s, had brought the stagflation of the 1970s. And so the neoliberal Democrats, and that's who they're called, there's a pretty famous Esquire article in 1982 that lays out their ideas. This included Bill Clinton, Al Gore, Gary Hart, Bill Bradley, Paul Tsongas, Tim Wirth, etc. And they rejected the quote-unquote bleeding heart liberals for deregulation, balanced budgets. And similarly, the Republicans, they made overtures to conservative traditionalists, but they made very little headway on abortion or gay liberation, which were two of the issues of the decade.
More of this on the online course at online.hillsdale.edu, The American Left from Liberalism to Despotism. It is available now. Dr. Kevin Slack is with us, Associate Professor of Politics at Hillsdale and your teacher for this course. Dr. Slack, there's one specific course, The Long March Through the Institutions, and you talk about how government funding, or our tax dollars, were used to implement these ideas of the left over the years. How did that happen?
Well, the radicals often fought a battle with the liberals in that they were able to co-opt the agencies and the institutions created by the liberals. For example, they often fought with the liberals over government spending in the Great Society in these programs like ACORN, the National Welfare Rights Association. There were the community action programs or the CAPs in which there was supposed to be maximum feasible participation on the part of the poor. And so the radicals would take this money and they would spend it on all these radical programs. It was to the point where it angered many of the liberals. In fact, one program, LBJ, personally axed, proposed by a James Farmer. He said he wanted an end to the, quote, kooks and sociologists in the OEO. Some of those programs, they paid for black nationalist Marxist theater on the streets of Harlem, or there was the, quote, hate whitey liberation school in Nashville, Tennessee. So radicals took over the agencies and the commissions that implemented those liberal laws, no matter your opinion about the laws themselves. So, for example, they interpreted the 1964 Civil Rights Act to mean the opposite of what it said. Title IX is a good example. So, you know, what you end up with, you know, the effect of the radicals in ensconcing themselves in education and bureaucracy is the result of a paid constituency, a veritable priesthood that clamors for simony in teaching identity politics.
Talking to Dr. Kevin Slack, Associate Professor of Politics at Hillsdale, his new online course, The American Left from Liberalism to Despotism, online.hillsdale.edu is where to find it. Today, why are the ideas of the left today, today's left, so dangerous to the concept of our Republican government?
Yeah, you know, to be clear, when we say left, I really think of our current kleptocracy,
mm-hmm.
which I see as a union between the oligarchs that rose to power during the neoliberal period and the identity politics leftists in the academy and bureaucracy. And they're the ones who constitute a state church that legitimizes those in power. I think all those neoliberal systems that were used to legitimize conservatives who were in power, right? Again, the neoconservative ideas, libertarian ideas, these things all found themselves in collapse after 2008. And I think that it's the danger of this kleptocracy, right, this union, this woke, great awakening that occurs around 2015. The great danger is that it destroys our concept of citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
So the Democratic Party today, it even denies the distinction between citizens and subjects. And so they welcome any immigrants, right? Some estimates, something like 5 to 7 million illegal immigrants under Joe Biden. They welcome any immigrants across the border who are going to displace the American citizens.
Dr. Kevin Slack, Associate Professor of Politics at Hillsdale College. He's your teacher for the new online course, The American Left, From Liberalism to Despotism, online.hillsdale.edu is where to find it. It is available now. Dr. Slack, thanks so much for joining us here on Bo Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks, Scott.
Up next, we talk with Joel Kotkin. His recent book, The Coming of Neo-Feudalism, is now available in paperback. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
In 1788, as the Constitution was being debated, James Madison wrote that the chief restraint preventing Congress from passing laws that apply to the people, but not to Congress, is the vigilant and manly spirit which actuates the people of America, a spirit which nourishes freedom. If this spirit shall ever diminish so as to tolerate a law not obligatory on the legislature, the people will be prepared to tolerate anything but liberty. Today, we Americans live under many laws that do not apply to elected officials and those who work for them. If we hope to preserve liberty, we must recultivate the freedom-loving spirit of our founding fathers. Learn more about the Constitution at ConstitutionMinute.com.
For more information, visit Hillsdale.edu. Hillsdale College, defending liberty since 1844.
Hi, I'm Chandler, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is President of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arnn, on the continuing relevance of the Constitution.
Many argue today that the Constitution is outdated because it addresses problems peculiar to the 18th century so long ago. And some of it does read sort of quaintly. But consider the injunction against titles of nobility in Article 1, Section 9, for example. Is that so outdated? The purpose of that injunction is to prevent the government granting special privileges for partisan reasons. This strikes at the rule of law, the rule under which we're all to be treated the same. The crony capitalism so common today, where the government gives favors and tax dollars to some businesses and advantages over others, is exactly the kind of thing the Constitution was meant to prohibit. The Constitution is not outdated at all.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. Go to ConstitutionMinute.com.
Many argue today that the Constitution is outdated because it addresses problems peculiar to the 18th century. Some parts of the Constitution do read rather quaintly. But consider the injunction against titles of nobility in Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution. Is that so outdated? The purpose of that injunction is to prevent the government granting special privileges to some for partisan reasons. This strikes at the heart of the rule of law. The crony capitalism so common today is a place where the government bestows favors and tax dollars on some businesses to give them a leg up over others. This is exactly the kind of thing the Constitution was meant to prohibit. Perhaps the Constitution is not so outdated after all. Learn more about the Constitution at ConstitutionMinute.com.
Hillsdale College, defending liberty since 1844.
The word education comes from a Latin word that means to lead forth. Forth is a value-laden term. It raises a question. Which way is forth? How do you know you're going in the right direction? The easy answer in our time is it just depends on which way you want to go. Young people almost always say that today. They've been taught to say that. But that's the wrong answer. At Hillsdale College, we understand education to be the pursuit of the highest answer to that question. Discovering the right way by reading the greatest books by the greatest minds in history. Coming to see the meaning of three ultimate and related things: the good, the true, and the beautiful. This is the way forth. This
is education.
Learn more at hillsdale.edu.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Check out our website, radiohour.hillsdale.edu. Find radio affiliates all around the country airing the show. We're joined now by Joel Kotkin. He is Presidential Fellow in Urban Futures at Chapman University, Executive Editor at NewGeography.com, and also the author of the book, The Coming of Neo-Feudalism, A Warning to the Global Middle Class, that is now available in paperback. Joel, thanks so much for joining us.
All right, it's nice to be here.
So what is this neo-feudalism you write about, and how long before you think it arrives?
Well, I think it's arrived. it's not fully formed, just like, you know, feudalism historically took many years. But there are certain patterns that are clearly reminiscent of feudalism. Like, you know, we're not going to go down, you know, Main Street and have to fight off guys in chainmail. Okay, that's not what's going to happen. But if we look at the lack of upward mobility, the sort of the reduction in sort of the global trade, if you look at demographics, if you look at the sort of bizarrely irrational and apocalyptic ideology that now dominates the upper classes in the U.S. and throughout the West, the parallels with feudalism are pretty obvious already. You know, whether it's going to become fully formed or whether or not there'll be some sort of resistance to it, that I can't tell you.
Your warning in the subtitle is directed to the global middle class. What makes this kind of movement an international threat?
Well, because the same things are happening in other countries. I mean, for instance, the decline in home ownership among young people is not just the United States. It's in Canada. It's in Australia. It's in the United Kingdom. It's in France. The turning away from family. One thing about the medieval era is family was not as strong as it became later during the period of the Protestant Reformation and particularly in the Netherlands. So, you know, you have a lot of these things are already with us, and they're happening globally. Now, there may be some more extreme cases in one place as opposed to another, but even China is now experiencing very low birth rates, demographic decline, economic certainly crosswinds, obviously authoritarianism that would, you know, make the former owners of Twitter excited beyond belief. Young Chinese are having a harder time buying property. They're having a harder time finding good jobs. So this is really a global phenomenon.
The book originally released in 2020 and the paperback now in 2023, there has been more time to consider this question about whether COVID and the pandemic exacerbated and quickened this process.
Well, we do know that it certainly accelerated concentration of wealth. It was a disaster for Main Street business. And, you know, how many of them will survive? How many of them will come back? I mean, there are some that have done brilliantly, but there are many others that have not done. What we see, for instance, I've been following a lot with this AI chat business and the sort of new AI-oriented technologies, but they're all just being bidden by five or six companies. I mean, the new model seems to be somebody starts maybe some sort of tech company with some innovation, and it immediately becomes part of Google or Microsoft or Meta, depending. But the kind of incredible entrepreneurial culture that I witnessed and covered in Silicon Valley, that's pretty much gone. It is nothing like what it was. The era of the garage entrepreneur, the sort of, you know, in many ways the archetypical, middle class aspiring person, that has become rarer and rarer. And again, this is happening on a global level as well.
A lot of talk about tech, Joel. How have the tech oligarchs, the ones we think of,
benefited the most, more than others, from the coming or the arrival of this neo-feudal state?
Well, because, you know, one of the things that they have is they've been able to get enough capital and have had, at least till now, a fairly lenient regulatory regime. So they basically can buy other companies without even worrying about the kind of things that, let's say, if three steel makers tried to get together, there would be, you know, there would be cries about it. But in this field, there's been more and more of this kind of consolidation. Also, because we've shifted to a digital economy, having 80-90% market share in critical areas, like Microsoft, for instance, in operating system software, and Amazon in online retail, and also in the cloud services. You're really talking about companies, one and sometimes two companies with 80-90% market share. That allows them essentially the kind of power that we used to associate with feudal lords. I mean, what's interesting is in the last decade, we have very few emerging tech companies that are disrupting things. You know, you just don't
right.
have it. You know, I remember in Silicon Valley during the disk drive industry, there were like 40, 45 disk drive companies. Now, at the end, there were only a few, but there was the pattern of innovation. That's another thing that we're seeing, which is also somewhat reminiscent of medieval times, which is that we don't have the kind of competition we used to have.
Joe Kopkin is with us. The Coming of Neo-Feudalism is the book, A Warning to the Global Middle Class. You outline some markers in the book, greater concentration of wealth and property, reduced upward mobility, demographic stagnation, increased dogmatism. Is there one that you feel is most threatening to society?
This is probably going to sound strange, but the dogmatism. Mm. I think mm-hmm. the assumption, which is very, very clear in the climate movement, that essentially democracy, which has arisen with capitalism, and at least in competitive capitalism, is pretty much gone. I mean, the things I read, for instance, the not only the control of the oligarchs and the inheritors who control and have the nonprofits, they're buying the media, in some cases directly buying it. I really don't feel that climate coverage paid for by the Ford or Rockefeller foundations, which are kind of on the lunatic end on climate issues. I really don't think that they're giving money to AP and NPR is much different than if Occidental Petroleum bought the climate coverage of the Houston Chronicle. I mean, it's like, why should... I know that they simply will not ever deal with a counterfactual or any, even like, you know, some very good scientists, Roger Pilkey, mm-hmm. Judith Curry, Steve Koonin, all of them are saying, yes, we believe there's climate change, but it's not as extreme a peril. How you deal with it is much more complex. But the media has become, I read stories and I say, did you ever talk to anyone else?
Joel Kopkin is with us. His book, The Coming of Neo-Feudalism, A Warning to the Global Middle Class, now out in paperback. We'll continue our conversation with Joel next. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Are you enjoying the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour? Then sign up for the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour email list. Just visit radiohour.hillsdale.edu and type in your email address to receive the latest episodes with interviews of Hillsdale College professors and friends. Again, don't miss an episode and join our email list at radiohour.hillsdale.edu. That's radiohour.hillsdale.edu.
Not one penny. This is how much funding Hillsdale College receives from the government. Not even indirectly in the form of student loans or grants. Not one penny. There are thousands of colleges and universities in the U.S. The vast majority receive around 30% of their revenue from government funding, loans, and grants. In other words, these schools are dependent on the government to stay in business. And they receive more than $150 billion per year from taxpayers to do so. In contrast, Hillsdale refuses all government funding. Why? The answer is simple. Money from the government comes with strings attached. Do's and don'ts, restrictions and mandates that, in small but significant ways, influence how a school operates and educates. But from the very beginning in 1844, Hillsdale has been committed to providing a world-class education that upholds America's founding principles and preserves the blessings of civil and religious liberty. Therefore, everything Hillsdale does, from the private loans, grants, and scholarships it provides to 97% of its students, to the completely free online courses it offers to millions across the country, depends on generous donors who recognize how much independence is worth. Not one penny safeguards the college's mission. Not one penny preserves the quality and integrity of a Hillsdale education. Not one penny ensures that Hillsdale can continue to be a beacon of independence for all of its students on campus and across America.
For more information about Hillsdale College, visit hillsdale.edu. That's hillsdale.edu. Hillsdale College, defending liberty since 1844.
Hi, I'm Joy, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is President of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arnn, on why the Constitution limits government.
James Madison writes in Federalist 51 that men are not angels. Their passions and self-interest often get the better of their reason and sense of justice. So we need government in order to protect our rights against those who would take them away. But for the same reason, Madison writes, government must be limited, because people in government have passions and interests too. Many Americans today forget this. Supposing that we can do away with constitutional limits on government, supposing that the unelected bureaucrats being put in charge of our health care, for example, will rule as if they are angels. If Madison was correct about human nature, this is foolish and dangerous.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To receive a free pocket constitution and declaration, go to constitutionminute.com.
Learning is hard work. Hard work requires character. Learning begins in faith. It must move upward toward the highest thing, unseen at the beginning, God. And freedom is essential to learning. Its principles must be studied and defended. Learning, character, faith, and freedom. These are the inseparable purposes of Hillsdale College.
Learn more at hillsdale.edu.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Joel Kopkin is with us. His new book, in paperback now, The Coming of Neo-Feudalism, A Warning to the Global Middle Class. Joel, considering all we've talked about thus far and the signs you see, what should we be on alert for? What should we be watching out for over the next decade or so?
What we're going to be seeing over the next few years is an attempt to take the technology of constraint that emerged during the pandemic. Now you have a situation where they're going to say, well, we can order a lockdown. It's a climate emergency. You can't get in your car. You can't have a gas stove. You can't, you know, you have to pay, you know, exorbitant rates for electricity. You know, farmers have to cull their herds. You can't use the fertilizers, which played a major role in feeding the planet as it increased its population. I mean, I think you're looking at a potentially very draconian regime. And as much as I tend to be more of a materialist in my worldview, I think there is a spiritual dimension that's very frightening to me. A very, you know, even to the point of, well, you shouldn't have kids because kids are bad for the climate. Mm-hmm. You know, we're producing these little GHG emitters. You know, we can't have that. I mean, the world that's coming out is something not even as, in some ways, more like the early medieval period, you know, before, you started to see the glimpses of the Renaissance, and as the learning of the classical world began to filter through, somewhat through Islamic and some through the monasteries. We're in a period of just distinct ignorance, but it's worse than ignorance because it's ignorance that doesn't know it's ignorant. It's ignorance based on some sort of faith, which they ascribe, instead of ascribing it to God, they're ascribing it to official science, as opposed to science, which should always be about questioning things. You know, I mean, I was brought up in a household that was involved in science, and it's just insane to me that you would say, oh, the science is settled. Well, we're always learning new things. You know, if you study history, things that we thought were definitely true turn out sometimes they're not true. Sometimes they turn out they're true. The idea that there is an immutable set of ideas that can never be changed and are always right and have only one interpretation is probably the most dangerous thing of all.
You ask a question or address a question in the book that's on the mind of many Americans today, especially in light of the purchase of Twitter by Elon Musk. And that is, what do today's oligarchs really want? Is it power? Is it something more? What do you think they want?
Well, as my old Latin teacher used to say in high school, it's all about power and prestige. One of the things about our modern oligarchy, and Daniel Bell was onto this 50 years ago, as these people become really wealthy, what they're really competing for is the regard of their peers. They want to be seen as enlightened. They want to be seen as far-seeing. So I think that's a lot of the motivation. The one thing I will say, even though I think he does seem a little nutty at times to me, but at least Musk doesn't buy the party line, you know, that he at least is not like all the other oligarchs who, you know, basically, you know, somehow, you know, they all went to the same re-education camp and all have the same ideas. But for a large part, it's really about a society, and this is what they believe. And there's been some very good interviews on this. They actually believe that, you know, because they themselves have elite educations, they think the world should be run by people like them. And I just think that's really where we see a group of people who, you know, and in the interviews that were done, a very good series of interviews done by one researcher, he said they don't see a role really for the rest of us. They see a world which is run by AI, in which a small group of people making an enormous amount of money have tremendous control, and everybody else is basically a peasant. And, you know, maybe, if, you know, and that's why there's so much interest, including from Elon Musk, in a universal basic income. Let's give the peasants, mm-hmm. you know, a couple thousand a month, subsidize their housing so they can stay in their rooms, never get married, spend their time doing pornography, video games, losing themselves in the metaverse, and, you know, watering their plants, you know, drinking, smoking, whatever they're doing. And that's their vision of humanity. And to me, it's a terrifying vision of what human beings can do. Their ideas, you know, it reminds me of my old friends who went to MIT, who always talked about themselves as tools. And that's sort of where humanity is going, except there's the tools who run everything and everybody else is basically, you know, superfluous. And I think that's sort of the vision. There's not a true sort of humanistic vision about the better world that's going to be created. And really interesting guy who was one of the creators of the metaverse and is an advisor to both Google and Meta, he said, and is a friend of Musk, said this. He said, to show you where these people are coming from, Mark wants us to go into the metaverse and lose ourselves in unreality, and Elon Musk wants to get us off the planet. Well, I don't see a lot of optimism there. I mean, I prefer Musk's version.
One final question for Joel Kotkin. His book is The Coming of Neo-Feudalism. Some on the right are celebrating the movement of people out of the cities into rural areas. Reading the book, you seem to recognize that there are pros and cons involved in this restructuring of the cities. What do you think are some of the disadvantages, the cons of the move away from the cities?
Well, I mean, what's been lost, and my background is, you know, one of my, you know, biggest selling books was A History of Cities, so I've been involved in that, and I just came out with a book that I edited for AEI on the future of cities. The negative is the city was traditionally an incubator of upward mobility, an incubator of, you know, where somebody came from the countryside with few prospects, transformed their lives, and lived better. Over the last 10 to 15 years, those kind of opportunities in cities have been declining, particularly in expensive cities, San Francisco, L.A., New York, Boston, where just getting into business, buying a house, paying the rent is prohibitive. So what you end up with is what the historian Fred Siegel calls the upstairs-downstairs community. In other words, you've got a group of people at the top and then a lot of people who are either on the dole or are the service class for the wealthy. That is not the vision of the city that I would like to see. The positive, I'm hoping, is as we begin to realize that work is going to disperse and that cities cannot be built around office buildings and with commuters coming from all over, because that's not really what's happening in predominantly. I think what we need to do is humanize the cities and make them, the cities have to wake up that they have to be places that people want to live in, that they want to stay in, that they want to raise their families in. And until they meet that challenge and address that challenge, we're going to continue to see very bifurcated cities. Now, I just want to make very clear, New York will do fine. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the long run, New York is New York.
Right.
There's nothing on the planet that is like it, except maybe London in some ways. But most American cities, I don't see where they're going to survive very well in this kind of environment. And some cities, particularly on the West Coast, Seattle, L.A., San Francisco and Portland, cities that have naturally everything going for them. They're beautiful cities. They're in great locations. But down here in Southern California, we have, you know, the best weather of any big city in the world, and we're squandering it. Having a dystopic urban environment does not strike me as something that anyone really should want.
Joel Kotkin, his book is now available in paperback. It is The Coming of Neo Feudalism, a warning to the global middle class. Joel, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Great. Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Up next, we talk with Dr. Timothy McDonald, Director of Sacred Music here at Hillsdale College. What is it and how do we use it here at the college? I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Are you enjoying the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour? Then sign up for the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour email list. Just visit radiohour.hillsdale.edu and type in your email address to receive the latest episodes with interviews of Hillsdale College professors and friends. Again, don't miss an episode and join our email list at radiohour.hillsdale.edu. That's radiohour.hillsdale.edu.
Many argue today that the Constitution is outdated because it addresses problems peculiar to the 18th century. Some parts of the Constitution do read rather quaintly. But consider the injunction against titles of nobility in Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution. Is that so outdated? The purpose of that injunction is to prevent the government granting special privileges to some for partisan reasons. This strikes at the heart of the rule of law. The crony capitalism so common today is a place where the government bestows favors and tax dollars on some businesses to give them a leg up over others. This is exactly the kind of thing the Constitution was meant to prohibit. Perhaps the Constitution is not so outdated after all. Learn more about the Constitution at ConstitutionMinute.com.
Hillsdale College, defending liberty since 1844.
Hi, I'm Devin. a student at Hillsdale College. Here is President of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arnn, on what the founders meant by general welfare.
The great preamble of our Constitution states that the purpose of the document is in part to promote the general welfare. Contrary to the modern understanding of that term, the founders understood welfare to mean public good or happiness. This was understood in accordance with the principles of the Declaration of Independence. Such happiness is contingent on securing to each citizen his natural rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Because this requires the government to be limited, the powers of the federal government were enumerated, and local matters were reserved to state authority. This was precisely intended to secure these inalienable rights and in turn promote the general welfare.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To receive a free pocket constitution and declaration, go to constitutionminute.com.
We all have a common problem. How do you live well?
What is the right thing for government to do?
What makes a good children's story? It's what makes a good story.
Why is the serpent's punishment to crawl on its belly when that's what it does?
It took 65 million deaths to prove what should have been self-evident.
It's time to pull back and recall the big picture.
We were made to know the best things and to live in light of them. Let's begin.
Learn more about Hillsdale's online courses at hillsdale.edu.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Find the show on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Hillsdale Radio for show updates and guest information. We're joined by Dr. Timothy McDonald. He is Associate Professor of Music and Director of Sacred Music here at Hillsdale College. Dr. McDonald, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me again.
On the topic of sacred music, this phrase, how would you describe that? How would you describe what you're directing here at Hillsdale? What makes it sacred?
Well, I think the most important, there are two ways you could look at that. One is the text, which is being integrated into the music, is usually of some sacred origin in our case, in the Christian tradition. So it's, the words of the scriptures, the words of the saints, the words of the liturgy, all of those things are kind of get a new incarnation through music, and that's sort of the purpose of it. It heightens the text, it makes it somehow special. It can interpret the text, for instance, as well, which I think is an important role that sacred music has had over the last 2,000 years. The idea of sacrality, this idea that there's a special place or time, so there are sacred seasons, sacred locations, and then, of course, there are sacred disciplines like sacred music, which have a special, precinct within the bigger world of music.
Is sacred music specifically different from what we might hear described as religious music?
That's a great question. I personally think that sacred music has, it has a kind of, it's more of a realm of the classical area because its origins are in the, what we would call the, on the side of art music. In other words, music that is created as part of a larger artistic endeavor that seeks to realize the highest ideals of a particular culture. That's what art does, and art music is in that category, and sacred music is a province of art music in that sense. Religious music could maybe even be a bigger category in the sense that it could be folk songs that are kind of a religious nature,
right?
Things that are a kind of we certainly have the tradition of work songs that have a spiritual dimension. You have things like pop Christian music, all of those kinds of things. I would say that those are within the realm of religious, but it doesn't mean to me I could say that maybe sacred music is perhaps a subset of religious music more generally, because just like religion has itself settled several categories, I think that's true also of religious music per se. Yeah.
Tell us about the role of sacred music in the programs here at Hillsdale College.
Sacred music's sort of a new focus in the music department and on campus here. It sort of is a specific vision that was articulated to me personally by Dr. Arnn when I was being interviewed and ultimately hired here. That Dr. Arnon had this idea that, you know, when the it's very much connected to his idea of Christ Chapel, mm-hmm. This kind of the beating heart, the center of the campus is this very beautiful chapel. That is one of the most important architectural projects in the last 50 years, certainly for ecclesiastical architecture. They wanted to see that enlivened and brought to life through music. That was always part of the vision. And so my job here is to work with our very gifted students in doing that and bringing beautiful sung sacred music to life in that chapel, which is itself a beautiful setting in which to do it.
Chapel is gorgeous, and it's a couple of years old now. And the program, the sacred music program, is now a couple of years old. How does the chapel itself support the sacred music program? How do they support each other in these efforts?
Well, you know, just as the premise of sacred music, as I said, is a world set apart from other kinds of music, the chapel itself is a place set apart, and so it is fittingly, dignified, and it has a balance. It kind of, participates in the idea architecture is sometimes called, number or arithmetic in space, and music is arithmetic in time, and those two things overlap in that beautiful building. That's the goal. Mm-hmm. We want two kinds of beauties to intersect there on that place. And so we have the benefit of a lovely acoustic. It took a little while for us to figure out the acoustic in there because it is very special. You have to learn to sing in a resonant space. You learn the space. You learn how to work with it. Much like, if you pick up a new cello. Mm-hmm. I mean, a cello is a kind of an architectural design. And you have to learn to work with the tones and make them expressive and fit your own technique into that instrument. And so for us, the chapel is actually the completion of us as an instrument. That is part of the instrument. It's the resonator of our instrument. So we've had a wonderful time over the last year and a half sort of learning to sing in there, learning to make beauty come alive. So that's been a fun thing.
What are the sacred music events that we've been able to present thus far, and what do you see as plans for sacred music in the future here at Hillsdale?
We have a three-part approach to sacred music here at this point. In terms of the performances, the heart of it is the chapel choir. That is the heart of the program. Within the chapel choir, we have a choral scholars program, which is a special scholarship program for gifted singers, gifted musicians who want to be very active in the singing life of the chapel. Those are very generously funded scholarships that we hear students and award those scholarships. Some sort of both students internally as well as students coming into the college can audition for those spots. What we do as a chapel choir is we focus on evening services on Sunday are going to be our first initial service, and we hope in the next semester, that is the starting in the spring of 23, to do near weekly Sunday services. Mm-hmm. In the chapel. And that's really kind of important because, prayer is cyclical. People pray on a regular basis. Every Sunday is the Lord's Day, and so we want to get into that cyclical life cycle of music for the chapel. A second area that we do is special programs like lessons and carols. Mm-hmm. Which is not really an adaptable format for making beautiful sacred music in the context of scriptural readings. We're going to do something similar to that on Palm Sunday. And then a third category is presenting sacred music in a concert format. There are many pieces of sacred music that tend to speak very well in that format. We recently did a performance of Fauré's Requiem, for instance, which is one of the great choral orchestral works. And to be it really the right fitting setting for that for our purposes would be a concert setting, and so we want our students to have the opportunity to sing the whole breadth of what sacred music is. And so through those three different ways, we think we can really get a rich sort of a deep dive into the repertoire.
Is sacred music still alive today, for lack of a better term? Are there new pieces being written? Is there new sort of roads to go down in that area?
Yeah, actually, I would say that sacred music, specifically choral music, is one of the most intensely practiced areas of composition right now, for several reasons. It's very hard to find a full, you know, symphony orchestra that's going to perform a new work.
Yeah.
It's expensive. It's, you know, it happens once and then nothing ever happens again. Choirs, because they have both a professional and an amateur world, there's a lot more interplay there. So if you write a choral work, you have a lot more of opportunity for it to be performed.
Mm-hmm.
And so composers have really increasingly turned their attention to that. To this genre of sacred music and writing music that will get performed in churches and by civic choirs, choirs all over the world, professional choirs. I mean, there's wonderful group called Voces 8, which does fantastic performances on YouTube, and a great deal of their work is the premiere of creation and basically dissemination of new sacred music that's being written today. So it's a very rich environment for new music.
Mm. Dr. Timothy McDonald, Associate Professor of Music and Director of Sacred Music here at Hillsdale College. Dr. McDonald, thanks so much for joining us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Dr. Kevin Slack, the new online course at online.hillsdale.edu. Joel Kotkin's new book is in paperback, and Timothy McDonald from Hillsdale's Music Department. The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is recorded at the studios of WRFH, the student-run radio station at Hillsdale College. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at radiohour.hillsdale.edu or wherever you listen to podcasts. The assistant producer of the show is Nicholas Alfonso. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
As we head into the new year, change is in the air, and we welcome Crossroads Auto Body Repair at 3045 Crossroads Drive. If the address sounds familiar, it's because owners Michelle and Jerry have been at the same location for over 12 years. And the business originally opened 27 years ago. Here's the thing. Michelle and Jerry know how important their customers are and wanted to offer you more personalized service. As the owners of Crossroads Auto Body Repair, they wanted to provide you with continued great service and add more value to your dollar. Now there's no need to wait so long for a free estimate. We'll get you back on the road. Call Crossroads Auto Body Repair at 530-226-0992. New name, same great service, and more. Crossroads Auto Body Repair at 3045 Crossroads Drive. Call 530-226-0992. That's 530-226-0992.
Hi, this is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
Hi, this is Brian Martin, General Manager of River Commons, an independent senior living community. I'm excited to share with you an exclusive program we are currently offering at River Commons called our Moderate Income Program. This is an in-house program offered by Raystone Senior Living. Those who financially qualify for this program will receive a reduced monthly rate. This rate still includes all of our regular services and amenities. Included in the monthly rent are 3 chef-prepared meals daily, weekly housekeeping and linen services, scheduled transportation, activities, utilities, cable TV, an emergency medical pendant, and more. Our community also has a very friendly family feel, all set on beautiful grounds with scenic views. To learn more about our moderate income program, schedule a tour, or lunch plus a tour, please give us a call at 530-221-2121. You can also visit us on our web at river-commons.com. We look forward to hearing from you.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.